You got new shirts and hats?
New shirts and hats.
What's your hat? You got a big old guy on the hat, and then what do you got on the shirt?
This is Big Mule Deer Guy. I got Big Mule Deer Guy. Actually, it says Big Muley Guy.
Big Muley. I like Big Muley Guy.
Big Whitetail Guy. I got one of those.
Let me see those. You got one of those?
Oh, yeah. I got a whole bucket of shirts. Let's see the Whitetail. Here's the Whitetail one.
Well, oh, Big Whitetail Guy. I like that one.
Big Whitetail Guy. That's just like a classic, the old trucker foam hat.
Mm-hmm. The foamy. What else you got? Oh, I like that one, actually. That's the back?
That's the back. Here's the front.
Oh, that one looks awesome.
Yeah, and I switched all my shirts. So these are all comfort colors. T-shirts, if you're familiar with those.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, like super comfortable, durable, good cotton. Like a lot better quality than what I had before. I had some people – I got a couple complaints as the shirts weren't as good as I thought. And like the logo would just completely fall off of them. Yeah.
It's supposed to. They're supposed to break in nice, right? Get some cracks
well,
in it.
Well, the comfort color, since it's like 100% cotton, the logos tend to stick on a little bit better.
Yeah, I'd never heard of comfort color t-shirts until I was in Alaska a few weeks ago. We went up there on a bear hunt. And there's this like little trailer right on the port where kind of everybody comes in and out. And there's this, in fact, they got a hoodie right now. It says Butt Whackers. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Butt Whackers is like this like little fishery halibut thing right there on the beach. And yeah, I bought a hoodie and a t-shirt, but they had a comfort color t-shirt, which it's been awesome. I love that thing.
Yeah, it's the end thing right now, I guess. It's what's hot. And the foam truckers. This is what all the kids are wearing, these big old school.
You're still a kid.
I don't know. I'm 30 now.
30?
I don't know if I'm completely sold on these foam truckers, but I'll rep them just so I can sell them.
Nah, they look good. I like it.
Yeah, they're the old vintage style.
Yeah. Well, we're going to catch up. Before I get going, let me hit promo code. So promo code, you can use the promo code GAMETRAIL. You can sign up for a Go Hunt Insider account. We're going to give you $50 back in the Go Hunt gear shop. You can also use the code GAMETRAIL. If you shop in the gear shop, you're going to save 10% on pretty much everything. There's a few brands that don't do promos, but pretty much everything else in the gear shop, you can use my code and save some money. Also, Matthews Archery. We appreciate those guys. I've been talking to Derek over at Matthews lately, and I'm excited for what the next year's got in store. And I'm trying to convince him to hook me up with a target bow because I want to start shooting some target.
I've heard the title; people love it. I was listening to a podcast with Bodie, and he's shooting the title.
Yeah,
him and Dan Staten were talking about it, and he says it's the best bow he shot.
I think Bodie's going to end up in a yellow and black jersey at some point.
I don't know. We'll see.
I think so. It's so wild that he's just still so young, but I think, I don't know. He'll probably eventually have to pick up a sponsorship. I would think it'd be advantageous, I think, as far as money wise goes. So what have you been up to?
Just getting ready for hunting season. I can't believe it's already July 4th.
Yeah. We're almost there. Married.
Getting married.
Yeah. Oh, I guess I should introduce you. This is Chris Neville, everybody. Chris Neville's my hunting partner, my hunting buddy. Chris worked over at Go Hunt, still does some stuff for us. I saw you did a little video the other day on building a paper tuner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Classic.
I'm going to ask you about that here in a second. But Chris and I have been hunting together for a while. We're gonna go hunting again this year. Chris has got a deer tag in my home state of Utah and a unit that I've got a deer tag in. So we're going to lump up and do some deer hunting, but it'll be good. We got different elk tags this year.
We got different elk tags, but we got good elk tags for the first time. We got some good ones.
You had to move to Colorado to cash in on the unit that we've been chasing. Right.
Cause we both had, you had 9 points too, didn't you?
I think I had 9 or 10. I can't remember.
Yeah. But yeah, finally burnt my nine elk points here in Colorado in a limited entry unit, which I've been scouting a couple times, a couple weekends out there. I was just out there last weekend and just elk everywhere. You drive around, just elk here, elk there, walk around, bump into elk.
Are they in areas you thought they would be in? or move?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I knew just from the research I've done and from talking to people that they're at like tree line. They're at 12,000, 13,000 feet, just like in huge meadows. And that's exactly where they were when I showed up, just probably 100 cows and calves, just a big cow and calf group way at the top of the mountain hanging out.
Yeah.
But I'm still trying to dig out the big bulls. You know, I've seen a lot of bulls, a lot of just like, you know, 5 points, little 6 points, spikes, but mm-hmm. nothing to really get you excited yet. But I know they're in there. You just got to dig them out.
Yeah. It can be frustrating scouting for elk. I know that year I had that Utah tag. I went up, I can't remember, probably 3 or 4 weekends. I think I scouted maybe 8-9 days total that summer. And every time I went out, I would find a few bulls, but just like you're saying, like younger bulls. And then I was just finding cows and calves everywhere, which I think, I mean, that's important because once you get into the rut, that's where the bulls are going to end up anyway, right? But mm-hmm. it got a little frustrating. Like I had a little bit of a pucker factor there where I was like, man, maybe I'm not going to find these bigger bulls.
Right. It is exciting though, just to the, like every time I'm going down there, heading into that area, just knowing like, this could be the day. This could be the day that I find that big one. That's like what keeps me going. It's just like, this could be the weekend that I find that big one, or this could be the day.
Are you stressed at all? Because you've never really had, I was trying to think, you've never really had a tag that you burned a lot of points on, have you?
No. Yeah, this is like the first legit elk tag that I've had. It's just been general and over-the-counter stuff. So, no, I'm not trying to really think too much about like, oh, this took me 9 years of applying.
It's not at all in the back of your head, though? Like you're not thinking about it?
The only thing I think about is like, God, if I get down to like the last day and I haven't shot anything, like September 30th, that's going to really suck.
You can't put that out into the world, have you?
No, that's like the only thing that I've thought about once. It's like, man, if I get to like September 30th and I haven't shot anything, like, am I just going to shoot a cow or what?
Yeah. Yeah. I know that. So I've had 3 tags in Utah, and those tags in Utah for the archery season, they end pretty early. So I think the latest I ever had one that ran was like maybe the 16th of September. And that one always had me pretty, stressed.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's like right prime dates to start getting things going.
Yeah. Yeah. And Utah, I mean, you look at it as a resident here, you know, I burn my points, I draw a tag. I'm on a 5-year waiting period before I can even apply again. And then I start to look at my age and then, you know, building up enough points to draw another tag. And I'm like, man, this is probably only going to be, you might only get like a couple ever in your life.
Yeah. Try not to think about it. put it off. Just enjoy it. Have fun. And like for me, like, I mean, you know this more than anyone. It's like the more work you put in, the more scouting you do. Like I'm trying to leave no chance for that to even happen.
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to do anything that I can, scout as much as I can, be in that unit as much as I can, hunt as much as I can. Mm-hmm. So like the chance of that happening, just go down is my goal. It's just give it everything that I have.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, since you live in Colorado now, and I would assume you probably had a chance to talk to, I mean, I know that you shoot like local 3Ds and stuff, and you've got some guys that you kind of keep in touch with in Colorado, but what's the general vibe and consensus of Colorado residents on this OTC change?
I mean, most of the Colorado residents are in favor for that, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them, because the big thing that you hear from a lot of the non-residents is like, well, where are you going to get your money? Like, we're the ones that are giving you all the money. And most residents are fine if the fee goes up, if they make the cost for resident tags higher. Yeah. Like, we're willing to cover that cost. But yeah, as far as like most of the residents in Colorado, I mean, I think CPW, obviously overcrowding is the main issue that they get back in their surveys, is the one complaint that they hear from everyone. Yeah. Plus there's more and more people living in Colorado. There's just a lot of people around, like recreationalists, camping, not even just hunters, but I think just the over the crowd, and I think it's good for anything. And I see it still for non-residents. It's not going to be a hard tag to get.
Yeah. You just have to pick your unit, right?
Right. That'll be the interesting part, to see how they divvy up. Like, are they going to do the same thing as Wyoming, where they do like different regions that you can hunt, or are they going to do? you know,
my
like
my understanding is that they'll go unit by unit. They'll just maintain really? The unit system. Yeah, that's what I think that they'll do. I think they'll just do unit by unit. And I mean, if you looked at the, because I mean, that's what they've been doing, right? So for the units that have gone to a draw system, so you're talking some of those units like in the central and then southern end of the state, those have transferred over to draw. My understanding is that what they did is they picked, you know, kind of a number that was based on hunters surveyed, how many people kind of hunted it, what they thought they could support as far as success rates and bull to cow ratios that they were trying to see kind of hit. And they just allocated permits kind of based on what was surveyed and then their objectives for the herd unit. So I think you'll still be able to draw a lot of those pretty easily. The one thing that I think is interesting, so like when Utah went from general season deer, like regions, right? And mm-hmm. it used to be that you draw tag in for a region and you could hunt pretty much any unit in the region for archery. And what I felt like is that I felt like people kind of like police themselves. Like people don't really want to hunt around other people if they can avoid it. So that they basically kind of moved out and spread out across the landscape. And then now you took a unit and you allocated a certain number of permits, and now you've put that many people on that unit that they're like, that's my unit. I got to hunt it. Like, I don't really have any other space to roam, right. You know? Part of me wonders, like, if you allocate, you know, a number of permits for these units in Colorado that are kind of based on the hunters surveyed that have hunted those units, like, really, what have you done?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, some of you, if you look, some of those surveys, you got a thousand people in one unit. Yeah. That is a lot of archery hunters running around in a single unit.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see how the numbers tease out the first year that they go to it, just to see how many permits they allocate for non-residents and kind of how they break it up. And then, I don't know, it's interesting because I know that you and I, like a few years ago, there was a unit that went to a draw unit. You and I applied for it. I think we drew it as a second choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like if you look at that same unit now, I mean, those are all going as a first choice.
Right.
Yeah. There aren't many that are bleeding through anymore to second choice. So people are kind of picking up on that and, you know, applying for those units. And I wonder, you know, 5 years down the road, is that going to be kind of the same case? Is it going to take 1 point to draw even some of these units that were OTC at 1 point?
Yeah. I mean, that's where I think it'll mm-hmm. eventually go. I mean, I think to start off, I think it'll be easy to draw, like no problems, but yeah, I think it'll become tougher and tougher to draw, but I don't think it'll ever, I mean, depending on, we'll see how these wolves and everything else, how the elk herds, the numbers. I mean, we have a lot of elk, no doubt about it, but
highest in history is what I heard, right? So 2023, they were saying over 300,000, 303,000 elk, I think.
That's why they dropped those damn wolves in there.
Yeah. Which is crazy. I mean, you compare that to a state like Utah, which is like maybe 80,000, 78,000, something like that, to 300,000. That's a lot more elk in Colorado.
Yeah. It's a ton. Yeah, that's why I moved here.
Yeah. And probably, I mean, if you think about where elk occur primarily in Colorado, you're talking like central part of the state, west.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of elk congregated in western Colorado.
Just hanging out, waiting for us.
Yeah. As a resident, though, I'd assume that people are probably pretty, you know, excited, I guess. I am interested to see how they allocate the permits and how many for each unit. I don't know. It may not alleviate a lot of the pressure that they think it might.
Yeah. And the one video I watched from Randy Newberg, mm-hmm. where he like breaks down like the actual law of like the rights and who has the right to the public land. I mean, it's the residents have the right before the non-residents. It's the law. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people who maybe don't understand that. So I'd recommend going to watch Randy Newberg's video where like he breaks down like the actual laws and what it means for residents and why they deserve the first choice, the right to hunt on the public land over non-residents.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, if you live in a state, you pay taxes in that state. You know, I mean, if you live in Denver and you put up with Denver, I feel like you should have, you know, better opportunity to hunt your home state than, you know, a non-resident. So I don't know. It'll be interesting. I would assume that most people are probably pretty excited about it, you know.
Hey, especially for an archer guy, I'm pumped. I mean, the rifle guys, I know that's still over the counter, but we'll see how long that lasts. But yeah, for archery elk guy, like that's the hunt that I like to do, that they did that. So I was pumped for it.
I think you're going to see more people that were, you know, archery hunters, but they were maybe a little bit more kind of middle of the road, like opportunistic, like, yeah, we'll go archery hunt elk. I think a lot of those guys that would buy a permit, drive out and hunt and make a go of it, I think you'll probably see more of those guys that'll trip over into second and third rifle OTC mm-hmm. tags.
Yeah. Oh, it'll be packed out there for rifle hunting. Oh, man.
Oh, buddy.
And I think I'm going to go out for rifle hunts. My brother's got a second season rifle tag I'll probably pick up. I got a fourth season, hopefully pick up a leftover cow tag. So
yeah,
should be fun running around with everyone in orange.
It'd be good. It'll be, I mean, if bow hunters thought that the woods were packed with pressure, I think maybe you give this a few years to where that's maybe one of the only over the counter permits they can get is a rifle tag. Then we'll see what rifle hunters have to say. Cause I think you're really going to see an army.
Oh my God. Everywhere. Well, it seems like for me, rifle hunting, no one ever goes more than a couple miles off the road. Too cold, sure. It's snowy. So like for me, I think it's almost easier to find elk because no one's really hunting that far off the road. Whereas like archery, everyone's hunting 5 miles, 6 miles, 7 miles into the backcountry. Yeah. Which it's like, man, maybe I should do some more rifle hunting. If I'm willing to hike.
I just, the thing I hate about rifle hunting, one of the things I hate, it's like, it's funny, like you could have less rifle hunters in the field than you do bow hunters, but the perceived pressure for me is higher because you have that sound, you hear a gunshot go off, you know, and those elk pick it up, they hear it and you know, they're on the move. It feels like those rifle hunts, those animals are just getting pinballed around.
Yeah.
So it's like that perceived pressure because you're hearing gunshots, you know, you're seeing people in orange, which are highly visible. So like the perceived pressure to me feels greater, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. It's like, it's such wild times right now. It feels like as far as like tag systems and management and
We got July 5th to have the, mm-hmm. is the deadline for the signatures to put the mountain lion hunting on the ballot. So
yeah,
fingers crossed that doesn't happen. I think they need like 124,000 mm-hmm. signatures, something like that.
Yeah. I've been seeing some funny, not funny. It's not funny. There's nothing funny about it, but just like Instagram reels where, you know, people are getting approached by people that are being paid to collect signatures for this. And just like the amount of misinformation and just propaganda that those guys are spreading to get a signature is unbelievable. I have a hard time believing that in the United States, you know, that that's the way the system runs, that you're going to allow people to be paid to go out and collect signatures. And in essence, they're allowed to say and spread any kind of misinformation that they want to collect that signature. And then that signature is going to be, you know, like the number of signatures is going to be the determining factor on whether or not the public will then vote on wildlife management. It seems
it's insanity.
It sounds so stupid.
And it seemed, I mean, because obviously they're scrambling right now to get signatures. So I've talked to people who will see them at like a Whole Foods, like an REI sitting out in the parking lot and just, and like the hunters, a lot of the guys that I talk to, they'll go up and like talk to them and have like a civil conversation with them and just like pick their brain and see what they say. And like, none of it's even true.
Yeah.
And then the funniest part is like, none of them are even from Colorado. Like they're from all around the United States. They get hired and they just come in here. So they're trying to spread things and trying to get people to sign things in a state they don't even live in. That yeah. doesn't even affect them. They have nothing to do with it, which is crazy.
In essence, you think about collecting that signature. Somebody walks up to you and you say, hey, you know, are you against, you know, you could say anything. Are you against the illegal killing of trophy animals for, you know, furs and skulls, you know, so somebody can hang a trophy on their wall? I mean, that seems to me at least like a pretty simple signature to get from somebody that doesn't have any understanding of what's going on at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wild.
And they're targeting, like I said, they're in these areas where they know they can get signatures. They're at places, farmer markets, REI, Whole Foods, where mm-hmm. like they can easily get people to sign, but
yeah,
we'll see. I think it's probably closer than we think, but 124,000 is a lot of signatures.
Cal, it is and it isn't, man. I don't know. It's interesting. I'm glad that they have to actually collect those in person. Like, if you gave people the ability to like electronically sign that, I think they'd get it in a heartbeat.
And my question, what's the due process on those signatures? So are they verifying?
Yeah,
they're
supposed to be verified. They have to submit. My understanding talking to Dan is that they have to verify those. There's like a verification process. So,
right.
You know, they have to count them, but I don't know. I mean, the pictures I've seen, the video I've seen, it's like some dude with a notebook, right?
Right.
It's basically like
just scribbles on it.
Yeah, somebody's signature. I'm like, I legit, anytime I see one of these, I have such a hard time believing that that's the process. I'm like, this is the process? This sounds so stupid.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't pass, and then we can really get on them.
Yeah, for sure. Tell me, I wanted to ask you, so I love a good hunting story. I know that you and I have talked about this, but I want to hear about your whitetail hunt from last year.
The whitetail hunt. I'm back. Yeah. Oh.
Where is your buck? Do you have him back yet?
Yeah, I have him sitting in the back here. I just got him skull capped, you know?
There you go. That's a big whitetail. Man, look at that. Gnarly buck. He's got big old bases. He's got a bunch of basal points coming off.
A bunch of just old deer. Definitely.
That's awesome.
So I just, obviously most people know by now I grew up in Iowa, and my parents have 6 acres, 7 acres of timber.
That's, I mean, it's it.
Six. Yeah. I mean, technically it's 12, but half of it's like our driveway. And then the back half is like actual hard wood. So it's about 6 acres, and it's surrounded about by 350 acres of timber. And it's just like your typical Iowa farmlands, timber patches all over. So had 3 points, burned those, drew that tag, and I was pumped. I was, cause I had whitetail hunted since I'd left. So it's probably been 6 or 7 years since I had whitetail hunted. Dude, I was surprised by like how much things have changed in that time frame. Like I was always hanging tree stands. Like I never, saddle hunting wasn't a thing.
Yeah, right.
6 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was always checking trail cameras. Like cell cameras weren't a thing 6 years ago. So like just some of those new things of being like super mobile, being able to go hang up in any tree that you need to, having cell cams, you're basically getting footage all the time and knowing exactly where that deer is at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Like all that kind of stuff made it so much more different in hunting whitetail and like what you could actually do. Like I remember the first picture I got of that buck, I was in Colorado elk hunting on a mountain. I got service. It was like September. Mm-hmm. And I set a bunch of trail cameras out. Like I was out there in August and I got a picture of them first time in September. I'm like,
Are cell cameras legal? So they're legal in Iowa? Are they still legal?
Well, I've heard they're going to change that.
Yeah, that's what I heard too.
There's some proposed changes where it's basically saying it's like a cellular device, which is illegal, sure. Essentially.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just like you said, you're getting real-time data.
Real-time. I mean, I would wake up in the morning and you see a buck that went by a camera and you know he's in that area.
Right.
So you go sit in a stand that's in that area. I mean, granted, you hope it's the right wind and stuff, but yeah, you know it's in that area. And like this buck, I mean, I was getting pictures of him all the time. Like he was all the time in September, like every day. And then it's funny, like whitetail hunting, it's like a whole different ballgame because like you're trying to know the exact pattern. So like I have this picture of this buck. He's always walking from the west to the east. It's always in the evening. So like I'm trying to pinpoint like where he's bedding, where he's feeding, where his travel corridors are, what's mm-hmm. his home range, his home area, and then like trying to find a stand that can go in that area. And I only have 6 acres.
Yeah, just that's wild. That's what I was surprised by. I'm like, 6 acres, you can pull a buck like that out of it.
I mean, I think the biggest thing when you're doing like small chunks like that is you can't overpressure. I've learned that just because I've hunted these 6 acres since I was 12 years old. So I know exactly where the deer are. I know the best spots. I know exactly where they're walking. And the number one thing that kills that area is hunting pressure. The more you hunt it, the harder you hunt. Like, so there'd be straight up days, like it's November 3rd. Like I just wouldn't go hunting.
Why? Based on wind?
Based on wind, or I'd been out for 2 or 3 days, maybe spooked a deer here. Like, I just didn't want that more added pressure, like just going after it for days on, days on, days on.
I would really struggle with that because it's like I have a tag in my pocket. The season's open. You know, what if? Like, I would have a really hard time sitting at home, like watching TV or working on my computer, knowing that I could be sitting in a tree stand. Like the what if, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the hardest part. And like, I tried picking up some other little properties around that I could kind of like separate my time. So I'm not like solely hunting this 6 acres. And really this area that I was hunting behind my house is rut. Like that's when you hunt it. You hunt it end of October through the mid of November is like the prime time. So I didn't go in there. I had all my cell cameras set up like early in August, and then I didn't touch it. I don't go in there. I hung my stands. Like, I don't do anything.
Is that the only buck? Like, was it that buck or bus, or were there other bucks?
He was the first like really good one that I got trail cam picture of. And then it was, yeah. I mean, I was determined, like I wanted to shoot this deer for sure. And I mean, it's one thing, like you see a picture right away, and you're like, all right, a deer, there's a big deer in the area. Mm-hmm. But then when he came back again and again and again and again, it's like, all right, he's living, his core range is very close to where I can hunt.
Sure.
So then I knew it, like the possibilities of killing this deer went way higher when I was just getting consistent picture of him after and after. But then about like October 3rd or 4th, disappeared.
Really? Why? What do you think?
I think he had just a really small core range. And then that October, you know, so usually it's like September, like when they go from their summer pattern to like their fall pattern. Mm-hmm. And I was getting pictures of him all the way end of September. So like, I thought that's what his fall pattern would be in that area. But I mean, it's such a small, small area that I'm hunting that I have trail cameras on. Like he could have just been 50 yard. Yeah. He could have, you know what I mean? Like even just cause you're not seeing him or he's not on trail cameras, you know, doesn't necessarily mean that he was not there. And so I went in like 1st of October. So that's the opener in Iowa. And I'm getting trail cam pictures of him all the end of September. Like I have the area that he comes through all the time. I have a tree stand set up, and it's like, it's a really tricky spot because it's like on the edge of a ridge, and he's walking the side of this ridge going into bedding. So it's like trying to find a perfect wind to hunt that stand. And the whole setup wasn't my favorite because I had to technically walk across his trail to get into the tree where I could actually have good wind to hunt him. Yeah. So like, there's a lot of things I didn't like about the setup. So like I was being super cautious. Like, I mean, if you ask any good whitetail hunter, like the first time you go sit should be you kill that deer. Like if you're going to a spot, like, and you have them pinned down, like your first sit, like you kill that deer. So I was being like super cautious, like trying to pick like the exact weather front, like cold weather coming through. But that first week I go out there, it's 90 degrees every single day. So I'm just sitting at home, not even hunting, 90 degrees. Then a cold front comes through and it's the wrong wind. So I can't sit that stand. I wake up, I look at my trail camera. There he is, walks by at 8 o'clock, daylight. Couldn't hunt the stand because of the wrong wind. So then I hunt like another day and I actually see him. He's like way down in a bottom. I saw him for like a second. He just walked right through. Then I went back to Colorado, and then I decided to like hit it the end of October through November. But in that time frame, like that was the last time I saw him, was the beginning of October. Then he completely disappeared through pretty much the whole month of October. And then I finally got another picture of him in November. But yeah, I was solely hunting that buck. I mean, I did have some other bucks that ended up showing up that were pretty decent. And I was passing up some good young bucks, but there was this one other buck that I would definitely have shot that I had a couple of good encounters for, but I was mostly just holding out for that big buck.
Take me to the day, actually. So the whole, I've repeated this story a number of times to people because I think it's such an interesting story, but tell me what happened like the day before, and then tell me about the day you actually killed him.
I mean, the last couple of days till I actually led up to killing this buck was, I mean, just pure whirlwind. So this is probably, I don't know, I'm on like day 10. I'm living in my parents' basement.
Like you're 15.
Yeah, like I'm a kid again, living in my parents' basement, just like hunting this buck. And I had this other buck, a humongous 8-pointer on like a different property I had permission on that was just like across the street. So I was hunting that. And this, I mean, I'm a sucker for a big 8-pointer, and this thing was huge, like probably 150-inch 8-pointer, just a giant 8-pointer. I'm in this evening setup. I'm on the edge of a cornfield. I went and bought a decoy because I was having the damnedest time of these deer in this field because they're just going everywhere. There's like no getting them to come like a certain way.
Right.
So I went and bought a decoy. Never hunted with a decoy in my life. I'm setting this thing up out there. The damn wind keeps blowing it over all the time. The wind blows it over, blows it over, blows it over, blows it over. So I just grab it. I'm like, I'm done with this thing. Throw it in the tall grass. I'm sitting up there, and I'm not shitting you. Like 30 minutes later, here comes this 8-pointer way across the field. I'm like, damn it. Where's my decoy? So I give him a couple grunts, and he comes just on a string over. But he's like 50 yards out in the field. It's pretty windy, obviously. And he's walking towards me. I stop him. Miss. Low.
You shoot under him?
Shoot right under him. Miss low. I mean, it was a pretty tricky shot. I was kind of like leaning forward a little bit. Yeah. Super windy. Miss low. He goes running off. Like I said, this is like day 10, day 11 of the hunt.
Yeah, that sucks. That's hard.
Been hunting hard every single day, mornings, evenings.
Did he give you that classic whitetail wave with the tail as he runs off?
Oh, yeah. Gone.
Like five.
Done
five
for. Felicia. Yeah. So then I was pissed about that. Next day, a couple of days, we're still hunting. I'm back in that same exact stand. It's windier, and I'll get out. I have my bow. I usually just put my bow up in like a peg, like a climbing peg.
Yeah.
So I'll just get up in a stand, and I'll put it in a climbing peg, and I'll hang my bow there. Mm-hmm. And it's windy again. And like my bow is kind of rocking back and forth on this peg. I'm like, man. It's really move. Like I had a bad feeling because I'm like, man, it's really, the bow's just rocking back and forth on this peg. And I pick up my bow and I'm like looking at the limb, and I can see that it had worked like into my limb, like had worked out an area, like cracked.
Like a little divot.
Yeah. Divot into my limb. So I'm like, didn't like that. I'm like, I'm just going to draw back. It didn't seem like it was terrible. Like, it was just a little wear mark on the limb. I didn't think it was too bad. I draw back, just a loud crack. I'm like, oh, shit.
Are you in the tree stand when you
do this? In the tree stand. Like, it's 3 o'clock. Like, yeah. Not even into the evening hunt. I'm just, like, waiting for things to happen.
Did you get all the way to full draw?
Full draw. Like, as I'm getting to full draw, like, and almost getting back into the let off, you just hear just a loud crack.
And is this the same day you missed that buck?
No, this was like a day or two after.
Gotcha.
But yeah, so loud crack. I'm like, oh my God. What are the odds? Like, just missed a buck a couple of days ago. Bow's broken. Once I heard the loud crack, you know, and knowing that the limb probably has some damage to it of some sort.
Did it like delaminate? Like, could you see it separate when you looked at it?
It wasn't that. That's the thing. It didn't look that bad.
Gotcha.
Like, I figured that there's probably like had to have been some, like, you could kind of see a crack running in it, but it wasn't like unusable, I thought. So I said, all right, I'm just going to get out of the stand. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to shoot this thing because who knows if it's even on. At first, I'm like, well, maybe I'll just sit it out and I'll only shoot it if it's 20 yards away, like super right. close. Like, if I miss a little left or right or high, like, it shouldn't matter too much. But I'm like, no, I'll just go back and shoot it. I remember I called you. I'm like, dude, what the hell do I do with this thing?
Yeah.
I'm like, do I hunt with this thing?
Yeah. I was out running my dog and I remember talking to you and I was like, well, I mean, you should probably put new limbs on it. And then I'm thinking, like, where's the fastest possibility that you could get a new limb? So I'm like, where's the closest pro shop to you? You know, maybe they could hook you up with a limb. Even if it's like not the right deflection, maybe you could get through. And then I think we hung up. And then I got to thinking about it and I'm like, I wonder, cause I've shot limbs. It's been a long time. Like, I had a Hoyt one time that I had a crack in the limb and I remember just peeling it back and then, you know, breaking the little bit of a sliver. And then I just sanded it down. And I shot that bow for a really long time, like with no issues whatsoever. So then I got to thinking about it and I think I texted you back and I was like, man, maybe just like real gingerly pull that thing back. And if you can shoot it, just see what it does. See what your arrow does.
Yeah. Yeah, so then I started shooting it. I mean, it was, I think it was like missing left, like consistent, mm-hmm. like 3 or 4 inches left. Shot some broadheads, just moved my sight a little bit. You know, I was shooting, all of it was shooting in the middle. Yeah. So I'm like, I felt pretty confident, like, and I was shooting 40 yards.
40 yards?
Yeah, and it was hitting in the middle. So I'm like, all right, you know, keep them in, like, under 40, like, I felt confident that I could easily make a good shot on a deer.
It's good that was missing left and not right, because if that was missing right and you had to move your whole gang all the way to the right, you probably would have ran out of room.
Yeah, definitely would have. Yeah. So then basically that evening hunt was wasted, and there's cold front coming in.
And yeah, so you only had like, what, 2 days left?
Yeah, like, it was getting down.
That was another factor I remember thinking, like, if you can still shoot that bow and you can still get it to shoot like 30 to 40 yards pretty consistently,
yeah.
and you know, you just move your sight, you've only got 2 days. Like, you might as well, like, if you can group, you might as well ride it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, cause I think I was going down, my brother had a third season deer hunt that I was going to help him out on, which is like mm-hmm. November, mid November. So I had a couple of days left of the hunt left. I mean, there was a huge cold front that was coming through. The spot that I had trail cameras of this buck, I moved my setup like a couple of days before that. I actually went in there and shot this buck. My setup was like more of like a safer setup, like not to bump deer, like a little more conservative. I went, moved that setup into like right into the middle where I always saw all the deer, and it was a pain in the ass. I spooked a good buck. Like, I was pissed. I was so angry. I'm like, I shouldn't have moved this setup. I should have just sat in this stupid setup. But like, where it was at, like, I wasn't, my chances of killing a deer weren't as good, because I needed that deer to come right down this one trail at 10 yards. Like, you needed a lot of things to go right. So I thought if I moved it in further, where like where I was seeing most of the deer, like where I could actually make different shots. So I moved it into this spot, spooked a buck. I was pissed about it. And I went and I'm like, gave it a couple of days. And then this cold front was coming through. I went into that spot, into that morning. I mean, frost, perfect morning, good wind, just silent. All of a sudden I look behind me. There's this buck. There he is. 5 yards, just
no
sitting
way.
Right. I mean, on top of me, just rubbing.
Walked in right under you.
Right underneath me. Didn't even know it.
How did you like? Did you just kind of peek behind you and see him, or did you hear something?
I had to, because he was rubbing on like, it's kind of like a ridge top. It's like super thick, and it dumps off. And he was on top, and the tree I had is like a little bit further down the ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I heard some crunching maybe like when he was already underneath me. So then I slowly turn around. I just remember thinking like, oh shit, that's him. 5 yards right behind me. And he's like, it's not like he's like a little bit behind me or like a little to the right or a little to the left. Like he is directly behind me. And I had to somehow figure out how I'm.
How big a tree are you in?
I'm in a huge oak.
So he's like directly behind the tree.
Yes. So next thing I'm like, shit, how am I going to turn around? So I had to take off my safety harness. I unlatched my safety harness from the tree. Uh-oh. So I could like fully like turn around and like, because your safety harness is like this. So when you go straight behind the tree, it's like going to pull onto your back.
Yeah.
So I took that off. I like slowly turn around. And he's just like rubbing on this tree. I'm like set arrows already knocked. And I get all the way around and he just kind of comes up. He's like looking, he comes up to the edge of the ridge and he's like looking down into the bottom. And he just turns like 3 yards broadside shot. Done. Goner.
Are you shooting, like, are you leaning out to the side of the tree to shoot him?
I'm right next to the tree. Like my arm is like next to the tree. And I remember thinking, so I would have been, this wouldn't have happened. So when I got into this tree this morning, so usually, right, you put your bag up like right to the right of you or to the left of you. You're like, your bag's like in the level. And I remember thinking like, man, if something comes behind me, like it'll be tough for me to shoot. Like if my bag is sitting right here. So for some odd reason in that morning, I screwed in like my arrows in my bag, like way lower. And that, like if that would have been up there, like it would have been really hard to get a shot off.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So for some reason I thought, oh man, I'll put it lower. Cause I have a feeling like a deer could come through here. But yeah, just like that.
The
just
small things, the details.
Yeah. And he just came out of nowhere.
Did you say 3 yards?
Oh, easily. Like, I mean,
are you just putting the whole housing on him? Like 50 yards then?
Yeah. And I was like a little bit high, but I mean, it was double lunks, just ran 20, 30 yards, fell over. And then another buck came in and he was like kind of messing with him. But man, yeah, it was, and it's one of those I'd never, in all my years of whitetail hunting, I had never targeted a single buck and like solely hunted a single buck for 14 days straight and then been successful.
It's kind of the best feeling in the world, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, now I'm definitely addicted back to whitetail hunting.
Yeah. That's so like to find a buck or a bull and you just hunt that animal, I think it's like the most satisfying thing in hunting. It's like the apex for me to like find a big, you know, mule deer buck, hunt him really hard and then kill him. Like the satisfaction and just like the elation that you feel when you actually finally kill that buck is unmatched in my opinion. It's like the highest achievement I think you can feel and that highest satisfaction you can feel in hunting. But in doing so, like a lot of the hunting, like the actual hunting itself is pretty boring and really hard, you know, there's not a lot of fun times and all those days leading up to that point. Like, it's actually kind of a grind.
And, getting frustrated.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody about it the other day and what I miss about just like, you don't feel like the same excitement that you feel like when you're just like, what's today going to bring? You know what I mean? Like I wake up in the morning, it's just like, okay, what's today going to bring? Like, I don't feel that excitement day to day when I'm hunting a buck, because I've learned that like most days, almost all of the days, you're going to get up and not even see that animal. So it's like you wake up in the morning and you're like, well, man, today's probably going to suck. I'm probably not going to see him today. You know, I'm not all that excited, but I'm going to go out and do the work. And then, you know, just eventually it just kind of happens. I think if you put enough time and effort into it, but.
And I think too, it's, I mean, for me, right. Whitetail hunting a lot and going after this, there's other hunters around me. Like
Yeah.
For all I know, this buck is dead.
Right.
Like, I was just praying. Give me any sort of, like, picture of him in the middle. Like, when it pop up after 10 days and not seeing him, and I got a picture at 2 in the morning of him just, like, walking by. I'm like, oh, my God, he's still alive. It's like, that's what, like, kept me going. It's like, he would give me a glimpse every now and then in, like, different areas. But so after I shot him and I went up to him, I noticed his eye was, like, just completely gouged out.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot that.
So one thing, I mean, for him to be 4 yards away, I have to completely do a 360, take off my safety harness. Like, his bad eye was to me. Right. So that definitely helped. Like, I mean, he essentially couldn't see anything over there. So that definitely helped. And I think that also hindered, like, his activity. And, like, I think that's why I wasn't seeing him in November. And, like, for however long he might have had this injury, like, I think his core area just shrunk. Like, I don't think he was going far from wherever he was, like, mainly living. So
you had trail camera pictures from, like, summertime, September timeframe where he looked normal and healthy.
Perfectly normal and healthy.
I wonder what happened. That's crazy.
Yeah. And then it was probably then I got a couple pictures of him. Like, I get one picture of him in October, and then I got, like, one picture of him at the beginning of November. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell if his eye, it was like night pictures, like walking by, kind of blurry, couldn't tell. But actually, I had a friend who lives, like, just across the street, and he had trail cam pictures of that same buck last year.
Mm-hmm.
And his eye was messed up.
Same eye?
Same eye.
I wonder what happens. That's weird. I don't know. I don't know enough about whitetail. Like, I don't know if they're susceptible to, like, disease or something in their eye.
Well, that's what there was something I looked up. It was like a brain infection can cause that. Like, if they have that and it comes, like, out of their eye, like, the infection comes out of their eye, essentially. I mean, that's all it was. Like, its eye was just completely pus. Just,
that's crazy.
Going out of it.
I get the take home story is, if you want to kill a big buck, you got to find one that's at least blind in one eye.
One eye.
And has a brain infection.
Yeah. I mean, his body was tiny, like, withered. Like,
really?
Tiny. Dang. For being an old buck, smallest body deer I'd seen.
That's wild.
Yeah, just, I mean, I don't know if it's just, like, he was super old and just kind of, like, withered down. I mean, obviously, he was battling infection as well, so I'm guessing it's a combination of both.
How old a buck do you think he was?
I would say, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he was That's definitely, cool. Yeah. And it was funny watching I saw pictures, my friend sent me pictures of him, like, the year before. And he was about the same. Maybe. I think the only thing I think he really put more on was mass.
Right.
Put on some more mass and some, like, stickers at his bases. But, I mean, I don't think he was going to get too much bigger after that.
Yeah. Are you going to – you mounting that buck?
Yeah, I'm going to mount. I got the cape in the freezer. Yeah. I just need some money.
Yeah, I know.
I just need a couple bucks before I can get him up on the wall.
Yeah, you got to round up some money for taxidermy bills. I feel that.
But it's nice to just have his antlers. Oh, you can just, like, look at them, hold them.
I almost kind of like that better, to be honest. Like, that buck that buck I killed last year in Utah is a big buck, and I knew when I walked up to it, I'm like, yeah, I have to probably mount this buck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got him here on the wall, and I like that I can, like, sit back here in my chair in my office and, like, look at him. But I do miss just, like, being able to pick up a set of antlers and play with it.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you should have some replicas made or something.
There we go. How much do replicas cost, I think?
I don't know. And I think it used to be that they'd have to, like, pour a mold of them. But I think technology is changing to the point now where they can do, like, a 3D scan, like, with a computer. And they can actually, like, almost 3D print one.
Damn.
Which is crazy. But, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Technology, right?
Right. Give me one of those.
Yeah. What have you been doing this summer to get ready for this year? Cause I know you have an elk tag, and you're probably going to pour a lot of time and effort into that. You also have a Utah deer tag. I know that. So you've got two archery tags, and I think you have an antelope tag.
I got a Wyoming antelope tag. Yeah, so I mean, as far as like quality tags, I mean,
this you got year's, some good. You got this, you got the setup for a pretty good year.
Yeah, I mean, 4 points for the Utah, I burned 9 points on the archery elk, and then I had 6 points in Wyoming for antelope. So like, they're all, you know, fairly good chances at good animals. Yeah. So I mean, right now my main focus is just scouting for that elk hunt, and then just, you know, shooting my bow. And I've probably shot my bow more this year than I have.
How many days a week are you shooting? How many arrows a day?
I try to shoot every day, like even if it's just in my backyard at 10 yards.
Yeah.
And I think for me, like the biggest difference for me this year when it comes with archery is I really focus more on like fundamentals. Mm-hmm. I think I probably hadn't done that in a long time. Just like basic things. And you know, if you ask anyone that's shot a lot of archery, and I mean fundamentals, the only way you can get really good at them is you have to shoot thousands of arrows. Like it's like, or if you have a, especially like when you're at our age and you've been shooting a certain way for a long time and then try to do something different, mm-hmm. or like if you're trying to fix a problem, like it's that same, you need to shoot thousands of arrows. Like, and that's kind of what I've been doing a lot this summer and this spring, is just focusing on some small fundamental things that I found that I probably wasn't as good at. And the biggest thing that I found for me is like the timing of my release. Mm-hmm. So I shoot a hinge release, and like timing and getting that thing to go off exactly when I want it every single time. The timing is the exact same time every time I get back there. Yeah. So that's, I've been practicing that a ton.
Have you played at all? You probably haven't. I don't know if you have or not, but have you played at all with like the Matthews shot sense at all?
No, I want to get one of those bad.
That's what's pretty cool, is you can actually, it'll track your timing. So it'll track, you know, your time to full draw, and then, you know, your hold time before the shot actually breaks. And then you can export all that and put it in a spreadsheet and look at it. But it is pretty interesting. It's always interesting to compare. The other thing you can do is you can make notes in it. So I think it's interesting to look at your hold time for, you know, a 60-yard shot or an 80-yard shot versus, you know, a 20-yard shot.
Right.
Compare those, because in theory, it's the exact same shot. You're shooting the same shot. Your perceived movement is a little bit different at further yardages because, you know, the target's farther out there. So I think I have a tendency to, like, over-aim at further yardages.
100%.
Yeah, when in reality, it should be the exact same shot.
Exact. I mean, that's the biggest issue I always find with longer yardages, is I'm aiming too hard. Get it on there, do the same thing, let it rip.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been watching? I think I texted you the other day, but have you been watching George Ryle's thing a week on Lancaster?
Yeah, I watched all them. And I mean, this on Last Chance.
Yeah, Last Chance.
Last Chance Archery. Yeah, I've watched those. Plus, I went back. I've watched a lot of – so, like, a lot of the drills that actually we've been doing this summer that have helped me with, like, my release timing with the hinge, like, mm-hmm. just expanding my palm, which is mm-hmm. all from George Riles and a video. And it's just – I just have, like, a – you know, I have this sitting at my desk with the D-loop, and I just practice. It's this. I just literally look at my hand with my hinge. I'm just releasing my palm,
and that's
extending my palm.
Like a shot trainer, you've got it at your desk.
Yeah, yeah. And that helps me with my timing, because I know when my shots aren't good, it's because I can't get my release to go off.
Yeah,
I'm in there too long. Like, if I can get it to, and I'm more steady, like for quicker shots than longer shots. Like, I mean, everyone's a little bit different in their shot process. Like my first 4 or 5 seconds, like that's when I need to fire a shot.
Yeah,
when I'm at in my aim and everything. So just working on my release timing. I, you know, watched that video from George Riles. He has on YouTube on like how he likes people to shoot a hinge. And for me, that helps me, because I'm not a hard puller. Like I've never been a person that just like yanks back. And that's why I've always had problems getting like hinges to go off, and I'll be in my aim too long. So that's helped me, like getting the hinge. Like I can almost, like I've gotten so good at it and I've practiced it so much, like I can almost get on, aim, and be like, all right, I want to fire right now. And I can make that hinge fire like correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I, so George has been doing, I think that guy is such a genius. Like, I'm so blown away with that guy. I think he's the best archery coach as far as like that does online, you know, YouTube stuff that people can just go in and consume. I'm always texting Crispy because I know Crispy, he came up through George's program, you know, the Hornets or whatever. Mm-hmm. Same with Colby Hanley, but I'm always texting those guys and I'm like, I'm continually blown away with that guy's ability to like break down like the little things about the shot sequence and, you know, all the little details and then explain it in a way that is so consumable and makes so much sense.
That's like, the biggest thing when I watch it's like, incredible. Oh, that makes total sense. Like,
yeah,
it's like super easy to comprehend. Like, it's not like where it's so complicated where you're like, what, how is he doing that? Or how does that work? Like, he explains it very well. It makes a ton of sense to why, you know, it's the proper way to do it. Yeah. And then it's easy to repeat. Like, it's easy to go out and do what he just taught you or showed you on his YouTube video.
Yeah. He's restarted. So he's got this thing a week and he's got three episodes, I think, up so far. And I'm like anxiously awaiting just to see what number four is. I'm like watching it like, okay, did he release it today? Just cause I'm so into it. But the other thing about him, and I think it's interesting, is like, as much as I've shot and as much as I've read, so like I'm probably 20 years, I guess, at this point of like reading, you know, everything I can find and watching all the videos, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of filtering through it like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, or this guy doesn't really make sense. And I'm kind of working through on what I think. And then I'm tinkering in my little bow shop back here playing with it. But one of the things I think is cool about him is like, I'm continually learning things that in 25 years, I haven't heard anybody else talk about or say. Mm-hmm. One thing he said the other day, and I'd be interested in your take. So I just the other day I was in Vegas and Chris Porter's like learning to shoot a bow, right? And we're talking through, you know, shot sequence and kind of the steps and, you know, building a pattern, if you will, like you need to do this, you need to do that. And one of the questions he had was like about shooting uphill or downhill. And like, I'll ask you. So what you're shooting uphill or downhill? What have you been told your whole life?
Aim straight, then move up. I watched the same exact one where with George Riles talking about it, which
was
I've been doing it wrong too, but I've always kind of thought like, this does feel weird when I do this shit, but I always do it. Aim straight. Like if I'm aiming,
draw straight.
And then if it's uphill or downhill, you go straight.
You're going to bend at the waist.
Yeah. Bend at the waist, go up or go down.
Yeah. And kind of keep your T form. So essentially like if you were shooting uphill, you would draw your bow into the hill and then bend up at the waist, like using your waist as a hinge to like, you know, keep your T in your form and bend up and shoot uphill.
Yeah.
And he, I don't know, I've always taught that. In fact, that same day I was in Vegas, I was telling Porter, yes, this is what you do. Draw straight, bend at the waist and like shoot uphill or downhill. And then I watched George and George is like, that's what everybody teaches, but you're all doing it wrong.
Yeah. And with a hinge, you can feel it too. That it's,
for sure.
Like you can feel the pressure is different. Like you can feel, like when I bend at the waist, and I go straight down, like my hinge almost fires. Cause like it's pulling down. It's like the pressure and the alignment's different, which totally makes sense. Cause you're moving into a different position.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting. The way he teaches it is essentially you line your shoulders up with the shot. So like if you're shooting downhill, you're going to tip your shoulders to match the angle of the hill. You know, you're like, you're shooting down at the target. You're going to match your shoulders. You're going to kind of hold your bow out in front of you, pointing downhill or pointing uphill, and then draw back into a full draw position. And the other thing I thought it was interesting. So he basically coaches, like if you're standing straight up and you draw into the hill and then you bend over at the waist, at that point, you're transferring the balance of your base, which is your feet, your stance, you're transferring that balance, which makes sense. So like if you're shooting downhill and you draw straight and you lean over at the waist, you're now transferring all the balance to your front foot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like you're transferring all that weight to your front foot, which is kind of taking you off balance. And the way that he coaches it is like, you know, get a wide stance, get your base comfortable, align your shoulders with the angle of the target, then draw your bow and execute your shot. And to me, I was just like, this makes so much sense. How am I such a moron that I didn't like think about this and do it?
Right. No, for sure. Yeah. And then I was where he was talking about the anchor position, like when you get to your anchor.
Yeah. What do you remember from that?
Oh, which, I mean, all that matters, right, is you're lined up in your peep. And then line up your peep and then let your anchor go where it needs to go to be lined up in your peep, which is good because when you're shooting different yardages, longer yardages, shorter yardages, if you're moving your sight, if you have a slider sight, if you are only worried about your anchor, like your sight picture is going to be different because your sight's moving. But if you go to your peep first, your sight picture is going to stay the same because you're going to your peep first and then to your anchor.
Yeah.
Letting the anchor go where it wants to go.
Yeah. There was a few other things. There was like two more from his series that for me, and I think everybody will kind of pick up on things that maybe are their shortcomings, but there were two others for me. One, actually three others. So one, deep breath. So he talks about taking a deep breath in and out before you actually draw the bow. And I've kind of thought, yeah, that makes sense. I don't know that I'm like cognizant of actually always doing it. But one thing he notes is like, if you take a deep breath in and out, there's like a 20 second time frame post deep breath that your body reacts to that deep breath out and in, and you're going to be more relaxed. So like, it's to me, it's just like, yeah, okay, yeah, cool. Now I'm seeing data, I'm seeing information. So that was one of them that like I want to work on, is like actually taking a deep breath before I execute each shot. The other thing I thought that he was really interesting, and I'm bad at this, is like a lot of the time I will come to full draw, I will find my anchor point, and I'm like settling into my anchor point, and then I'm looking at my housing and I'm aligning my peep in my housing, and then I'm starting to aim. Like I'm putting the pin on the target, right, that I want to hit. And he talks about finding the target, putting your pin on the target, like the spot that you want to hit before you actually come into your anchor point.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another one for me that like the light bulb just went off. And I'm like, my hell, how? Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't I do that?
I know it's I've single-handedly like this summer been just doing a lot of like the stuff that he talks about.
Yeah.
And it's helped me a ton. Yeah, like all of those small things. And like the one thing, like I was talking about my timing on my release, like he talks about when you get into your anchor position, like if you shoot a click, like you anchor, click. Like yeah. your shot process is like ready to go. Like that's like your like starting, like anchor, click. Yeah. Like for me before, I'd get in, I would anchor, I'd level, I'd do all this. I'm not even to my click yet. And then I'm 10 seconds into my shot, 12 seconds, like I haven't even fired it yet. So yeah. Getting to like my click, you know, I anchor, click, yeah. And I'm ready to go. And then it's like more consistent because now it's like a sound and a thing that I can do. Like I know when I anchor, I click, get right to my click.
He also talks about coming to full draw. So he's like, as you come to full draw, your shoulders are kind of up and they're like a little bit tensed and like up. He's like, as you come to full draw, he's like, keep your release out away from your face, like an inch or two. And like, as you come to full draw, keep that release out away before you go to your anchor point, your actual jawline, and like, let it kind of sit and let your shoulders relax like down and in. And then he's like, that's basically you're setting up your muscle position. And then you kind of come into your anchor point. And I've watched a lot of professional shooters. I mean, I've gone to the Vegas shoot a bunch of times and you watch those guys on the line and pretty much they all do that. Like they'll draw the bow away from their face. They'll kind of come to full draw with the string out away from their face and they like settle and then they kind of relax their shoulders down into their shot. And then they come into an anchor point before they like wrap their elbow back in around them. And I think I do that, but it was just like another little thing to like, okay, yeah, I need to be aware of that. I need to think about it. So there's like all these little tips and tricks, and I'm just continually blown away by that guy's ability to like teach me something that I haven't really thought about.
Right. No, I almost want to do his.
Oh, class. Yeah, me too. I looked it up online yesterday. I was like,
he'll do it remotely.
Yeah, remotely.
I'll set up a camera and shoot in front of him. He can tell me what the hell I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, I think I looked at his price. I think it's $100 an hour. But I'm like thinking in an hour of shooting and working with that guy, I feel like the amount of ground I could gain would be more than worth it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I highly recommend if anyone hasn't heard of him or hasn't seen any of his stuff. I think if you can go to YouTube and type in like George Riles and it'll a bunch of different things will come up. And all of his stuff, like he's the one person that I probably like seek out to look for information and it works and it's always worked for me. Like it's easy to comprehend. It makes total sense. And it's when I go out and then implement it in the field, like I have a good base of like what he just explained and it's like easy to practice and it's always worked for me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It makes total sense. And I love that after 20 some years of shooting a bow and arrow and like, I feel like I've been like a pretty good student of the game. Like I've done all the tinkering. I've done all the trying. Like I'm constantly like working on these things and I'm looking for like the next little thing that's going to help me be that much better. Everything he says always kind of resonates and makes sense. And it's just like you're saying, you start to put it into practice and you're like, okay, yeah, I can see results. I'm getting better.
Yeah. I mean, I think he talked about it. And I think it was in the first video for his first thing of the week. Your bow, for the most part, is doing its job. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a machine. It's going to do exactly what it's supposed to do every time. Like, that thing is consistent. The inconsistencies come from yourself. Your fundamentals, your shot process, that all comes from you. And I think that's what a lot of people do is they end up like start to mess with their bow. They think they need a different stabilizer. They need a different sight. Like that's not going to make you a better shooter. You're not going to become a better shot because of the equipment on your bow. It might help a little bit here and there, but for the most part, it's yourself, your fundamentals, your shot process, your execution, and like doing that like a robot over and over and over again. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to get to is like just pure robot.
Yeah. We went to, so Brady, me and Lorenzo, we went to the SIG Art Games, right? So Archery Rifle Challenge in Bozeman. And I got up there the first night and I'm like shooting arrows and I'm not shooting good at all. Like it's just, I'm not shooting good. It's just
hate those days.
Yeah. I've got the jitters. I feel like I've had way too much caffeine that day. I felt like I didn't sleep that night, which I didn't. You know, and I'm like making these excuses in my mind and I'm like shooting arrows and I'm like, man, I'm just sucking. Like I'm just not shooting good. I'm better than than what I'm shooting. And, Lorenzo comes out, he's shooting some arrows and I'm shooting 300 spine. He's shooting 250 spine and, similar arrow lengths. You know, I think his arrows are like 30 or 40 grains heavier than mine, but just like for kicks and giggles, I'm like, I'm going to shoot your arrows. Let me shoot some of your arrows just to see what they do. Right. So I start shooting his arrows and like pretty instantly I can see my groups like shrink right down. Like they're definitely like shrinking in. Like I'm shooting better groups with his arrows and I start to look, I'm thinking about spine, you know, that's a stiffer arrow. I had lengthened my draw length by a half inch. This was like a new dozen arrows. So it was a different brand of arrows, even though it was the same spine, but I'm like looking at those kinds of things and I'm like, man, yeah, these 250s are grouping better. They're shooting better. So we get up the next day and he's like, man, what are you going to do? And I'm just like, you know, here's the thing is like those 300 spine arrows that I'm shooting, like, you know, that are my arrows. Like reality is I have a good sight tape. The bow is tuned. I've shot it through paper. Like it'll shoot a clean hole through paper. Reality is maybe a 250 spine is like a better, you know, fit for this bow as far as like group tuning goes. But reality is like, if I do my job and the pin sits on the animal and I execute a good shot, the arrow should go in the middle. And right. I thought about it. I started thinking about it and I'm like, you know, and I got up early that day that we were doing like the archery competition before everybody. And I went out and shot arrows and I shot amazing. I shot great. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I was like, here's the thing is like, maybe the setup isn't completely optimal. And I talked to Kyle Douglas when we had him on the episode, he was telling me that the first time he ever won Vegas, he's like, that bow had a real nasty high left hair. It wasn't traditionally tuned. Like that bow wasn't set up to like, you know, traditionally tuned with what we would consider a tuned bow, but it, you know, obviously he won Vegas, but it's the person behind the bow and your ability to execute a shot. And if the pin is in the middle and you're able to execute a shot, it'll go in the middle.
Right. 100%. Yeah.
So for me, like, yeah, I'm going to come home and I'm going to build some 250 spine arrows. Right. I'm going to do it and I'm going to play with them and I'm going to do, you know, group tuning, paper tuning. I'm going to play with it and see if reality, like, that is the case. And maybe it is, maybe they do group better for me, but take home message is like, do the work on yourself and it'll hit middle as long as you do your work.
Yeah. Cause I think I find myself in that sometimes where like, oh, I'll shoot bad. I'm like, oh, maybe I need to switch up my stabilizer.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to mess with my release timing, or maybe I need to put on a different sight.
Yep.
All that stuff. And then in reality, it's just, you probably were shooting like shit that day.
Yeah.
Couldn't get, something was off, but.
The guy behind the bow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tell me, you've got your own archery shop. I can see your press there in the background. What pieces of equipment that have you bought or put together in the last few years that you feel like have been like the biggest difference makers for you at home?
Well, I just bought a draw board.
Okay.
So that's been huge, cause I just put new strings on my bow. I mean, obviously cam timing, I think something that you should look at as much as you can after a while. So I hadn't had a draw board. I put on my bow with the old strings and my cam timing's been off, and I've probably been shooting that for months with off cam timing. So just like a small thing like that. And then just being able to check your draw length and having all those measurements be the same for every single bow. Mm-hmm. Cause like, I feel like with the bow I have now, the draw length is probably the best that I've had and I shoot the best with it. And now that I have a draw board, like I have them, you know, the numbers down. So like I can make every bow this exact draw length, which is nice. And then, yeah, the bow press, obviously I have a last chance bow press, last chance draw board. Are kind of like the two main things.
I've been shocked. I think it's a good point. You talk about a draw board. I've been really surprised because for a bunch of years I was just like, I'll feel it, you know, like I can feel the difference in cam timing, right? Or I will tune and I'll be able to kind of see the differences in what my paper tears are telling me based on what I think my cam timing is doing, right? For a lot of years, I thought, man, I will feel the difference, or I'll be able to like draw my bow in a mirror and look at it and I'll feel the difference. I thought the same thing about draw length. Like if I had a bow that shot and aimed really well, I thought surely I can set up another bow and I'll be able to feel that difference.
Right.
And I can't.
No.
Not really. I mean, I can with draw length a little bit. I mean, I can definitely feel the difference between a bow that doesn't aim well and one that aims well based on where I think the draw length is, but like the ability to use a draw board to get exacts, I highly underestimated that.
Yeah, no, it's crazy how much, you know, tinkering and dialing in. I mean, I've probably shot a different draw length for all I know the last 4 years, you know, cause right. I didn't have a draw board. So I was just putting on the mods thinking, all right, this is 29 and a half for all I know.
Yeah.
And it could be a half inch here or a half inch there, which is going to change how you hold and how you aim. But now that I have it down and marked, like now I can build the same bow and I know this draw length is going to be good for me. I know I can hold well. I know I can aim well with this draw length.
Yeah. My V3X, which is one of my favorite bows. I love that bow. I seem to shoot it really, really, really well. And I've shot it for a number of years. I mean, since it came out, and I love that bow. And then, you know, I get the lift and I order it in the exact same draw length and I pull it back and I'm like, man, it feels good. Like I'm shooting it pretty good. I would have like times where I'm just like, man, I don't know. I'm kind of struggling with it a little bit. And then, you know, I talked to the guys at Matthews and they're like, hey, yeah, we've tightened up the draw length. Like the bows that are shipping out now, like they're much closer to actual, you know, spec draw length. And I don't really care. It's neither here nor there whether previous models ran long. And I think that's kind of the rumor. I think they would admit it that they run a little long, and it didn't affect me at all because it was just like, whatever, you know, it works for you. As far as your draw length goes, you just need to get there, whether it's like twisting cables or whatever it might be. But, so yeah, I started thinking about it and I had it like in the back of my head is like, maybe this lift, maybe the draw length is like a little bit shorter than what I'm used to and what aims and holds really well for me. So I got a 30 and a half inch mod, and then I cut the D loop off and I shortened the D loop because I had been shooting a pretty long, you know, longer D loop.
Right.
Shortened the D loop, and it was like instantaneously. I'm like, this bow aims so much better.
Yeah.
Just like literally in an hour.
Yeah. Just a tiny thing.
Tiny bit.
Yeah. The draw length is probably more important than what some people might think.
Yeah.
But as far as like aim and hold, like if you can get that draw length and you can find what is like optimal for you,
mm-hmm.
get a draw board so you know exactly what that is so you can make that in every single bow.
Yeah. I always think too, like if I go to a pro shop or I go to, you know, the range and a shooter, or if I'm in Vegas and those guys are shooting down there, I always think like, man, you don't know. And I mean, I get not everybody's like into archery, like, or bow hunting, like we might be, but I always think like, man, you guys are missing out on the ability to like really fine tune your equipment to you.
Yeah. Makes it so much better. You don't have to run in
to
the archer shop. You have to sit there and wait. Like you can do everything yourself. I mean, there's YouTube videos and information out there for anyone to be able to do this like really easily.
And if you go to a bow shop, a bow tech, and you tell them like what you're feeling and thinking, like the best communicator in the world isn't going to adequately be able to tell that person what it is that you need done. You mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Right.
Like you really got to be able to shoot the bow yourself, hold it at full draw, know what that feels like, and then have the tools and the understanding to then make adjustments to your equipment to get the best out of it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time is I'll make a change. I'll go shoot, mm-hmm. maybe shoot for a couple days. Didn't like it. Don't like it. Doesn't feel right. Like I need to tinker a little bit more. It's like, if you went into a bow shop and you made a change, like you just think, all right, that's good. Like this is it. And you probably wouldn't go back to maybe change it a little bit more to get it to like even more perfect and fine tuned to what you need.
Yeah. I agree. I think there's like those purchases in, you know, hunting and in gear. Like I've always said, you know, boots, backpacks, sleeping bag, I think is worth spending money in. Optics. I've always said like spend your money in optics. And then I really honestly feel like in archery, you're doing yourself a massive disservice by not having a bow press.
Yeah.
And a draw board and not. And I get it. I mean, I know everybody's not into it at the same level, but like, if you really think you're going to want to bow hunt and you really like archery, like buy a bow press.
Yeah. I mean, what are they? $300 This, the last chance green. Like it's.
Yeah. $399, something like that. I mean, $400. They're not too bad, but.
Yeah. And you have that thing forever.
Yeah. And I think it's been one of the best purchases I've made in archery.
I do need a new bow vise.
Yeah.
A good quality bow vise, man.
Yeah.
Those are nice. Mine, I had the last chance one.
Yeah.
Like the like very generic.
Yeah, the older one. You don't have the new one with the ball.
No. The ball. Oh.
I've got one of those. It's pretty great.
Yeah, mine right now is to get it level, it's a lot of like dink, dink, dink back and forth.
Yeah. Time crunch, huh?
Yeah, time crunch is right.
Yeah. What arrows are you shooting this year?
I'm shooting the same exact arrows that I've shot for
forever.
Yeah, it's those gold tip Pierce Platinums. I was thinking about changing the outserts on them and all this stuff, but I have like a lot of them and they shoot well. Like I know the sight tapes, like I have all my marks like with that arrow, the weight and everything. And I don't really feel like messing with a lot of stuff. Once I have a good setup, like especially with an arrow, and I hate building arrows, I hate messing with arrows. So once it shoots good and goes, so I'll probably just keep running that same. I did switch veins at the QTI.
Oh yeah, you did. Do you like
the
them?
Veins? Oh, love them.
What are so you they're are you shooting the 2.3s or?
Where are these are things? They... Yeah, I think so. They're basically the same as the Blazers. The heat veins. They might be, I mean, I put them up side by side. Mm-hmm. These have a little bit more vein, just a tiny bit, like right here on the front end, it's a little bit higher. So it's,
and then they're kind of a shield cut at the back.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've shot really good for me.
Why do you like them?
Oh, they stick on real nice and they don't fall off. So I don't have to mess with them and put new ones on all the time. Yeah. Easiest, by far the easiest to glue on an arrow, Q2I. Put them on, don't have to mess with it, and they stay on.
Gotcha.
That's like usually the biggest thing with me with Vanes. If I put it on and that damn thing comes off like in a day, done. I'm not going back. That's why I always like the blade, like blazers.
Sure.
I mean, once those things are on, they're on.
Are those fairly stiff?
Yeah, they're fairly stiff.
Yeah.
Yeah, not too bad. But yeah, they're a little bit lower profile than, like, I had tack Vanes last year. So a little bit lower profile, which I like, probably a little bit more quiet. And I don't know, the lower profile, more than anything, is just like worried about like hitting brush.
Yeah.
Like I'm not worried about hitting my rest. Like I could have a huge flush on and it's not going to hit my rest. Like my rest timing's good, but more than anything, like down range, if it's a tight shot, like if it like nicking brush or hitting something. So, and it's a little bit more quiet. Plus we're trying to go shoot some deer. So I need something that don't duck it too bad.
Yeah. Did you see this reel we put out? We did this Mythbusters podcast on the Big Hunt guys. And we were talking about, I was actually pretty surprised. So I asked that question to Brady about the 6.5 Creedmoor, cause I knew people would like kind of be interested in that. I looked the other day, I think that has like 480 some thousand views. I was blown away at how passionate people were about rifles, but we put one out about mechanical versus fixed blade. I was curious as to your opinion. You still using mechanical?
Yes. 100%.
All in, huh?
And if anyone asked me what they should shoot, I'd tell them mechanical.
Yeah. I agree. I'm still surprised.
Especially, I mean, majority of the people, one, do not shoot their bow as much as you and I. They don't tune their bow. And then to throw on a fixed blade, like, it's just not a forgiving setup. And you're just going to run into more problems that you don't know how to fix, that you don't know what to do. Then if you just put on a mechanical, it's going to shoot straight. You're going to have the same amount of confidence. You won't have to worry about anything. And it's going to do just as good as a fixed, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, you were kind of the guy that convinced me to go back to a mechanical, to be honest. I'd shot fixed for a long time and I had pretty good luck with them. I think, you know, and talking to you, you're like, I remember sending you a text and I was like, I don't know, I'm nervous. And you were like, just do it. And I was like, really? Sure. And then, you know, tinkered with them, played with them all summer and shot them. And then after shooting, so I'm shooting the sever heads, but after I shot the first animal with them, I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, like this makes sense. So to me, there's been kind of a paradigm shift in my frame of thought, but I was really surprised. I read through the comments today. And one of the comments I said was like, it said, fix can't fail. And yeah. I was like, fix can fail. They can just fail you in different ways.
Yeah. A fixed, if you're right, there's not as forgiving. Let's say if you miss your spot, I have a 1.5 inch cut diameter, fixed an inch. If I miss by 1/2 inch in the back, instead of getting, you know, some lungs and back of the liver, I'm in guts.
Well, they can also fail you in the fact that they're not as accurate.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Definitely not as accurate.
To me, I definitely think you can tune a fixed blade broadhead to fly well. I don't think they are as forgiving, especially like if you're shooting in different scenarios, you're shooting uphill, downhill, side hill, you know, wind.
You're nervous. You have a little added torque.
Yeah, your form's not perfect. I definitely think a fixed blade is not as forgiving. So in that regard, I think they can fail. The other thing I think they can fail is they can definitely fail to provide a good blood trail.
Yeah.
Which
100%.
I have not had great blood trails with fixed blade heads.
No.
Have you?
No. I hate those things. So, I mean, I started shooting mechanicals when I was 12 years old because I wasn't that great of a shot. So I needed the biggest mechanical broadhead. I went from not being able to find deer because I was shooting a Montech G5. And, you know, if I was a little back, in the guts. Finding that deer is a lot harder than if I used a 2-inch mechanical broadhead. If I hit that thing in the guts, like, it's going to do more damage, probably get a little bit of liver, maybe a little bit of lungs, and it's going to be a lot easier to find. That's like my first experience and why I switched. Mm-hmm. And I made it, and this is when I'm 12 years old. I'm like, well, these are way more forgiving. Like, mm-hmm. I don't have to hit a perfect spot when I have a 2-inch cut. Like, it's going to help me out in the long run.
What you're aiming for. I mean, you're aiming right. for a small, I mean, you are aiming for a small spot. Nobody's aiming to hit anything in the guts. Yeah. Or the shoulder for that matter.
Yeah. But, no. Yeah. I think they're just flight wise, more forgiving, mm-hmm. bigger cut, going to be more forgiving. I mean, I think that's what everyone's trying to do with their bow setup, right? You want the most forgiving setup. So there's not, you know, as much chance for error or something to go wrong.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder though. I mean, you talk to everybody they talk to that is like fixed, just like die hard on the fixed train. You know what I mean? They're like, I want penetration. I want cut on contact. If I hit a bone, I want to be able to get into the bone. I was curious. I watched Born and Raised the other day. Those guys did a video where they were shooting elk, you know, shoulders.
Yeah.
Did you watch that?
Yeah, I watched that one.
So he's shooting that at like 10 yards and he's shooting it right into the bone, the shoulder bone, with a fixed blade head, like a QAD, you know, single bevel. Like, they're not punching. You're not punching that through.
I mean,
at 10 yards with a fixed blade head.
If you hit anything in the shoulder with whatever broadhead it may be, fixed or mechanical, your chances of finding that are not very good. Doesn't matter what broadhead you shoot.
Yeah, they're not punching it through that shoulder bone. Now, if you get into the actual scapula, they're punching that fixed blade head. But I would make the argument you're probably going to, and it would be interesting to test, but I would bet you're probably punching a mechanical through as well.
Right.
With a modern compound bow.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had a friend of mine text to me last week about shooting his fixed broadheads. Can't get him to fly straight. How he should tune it, what he should do. I told him, well, you know what you should do? You should put a mechanical on.
I think you should tune it. I think you right. can tune.
I know.
I've said this before. Like, I'm guilty of saying this. I've said this. Like, if you can't get a fixed blade to fly, you just need to dive deeper into the rabbit hole of tuning. And I do think that there's truth to that, but you get it. It's like I said, you get into a hunting situation. There's definitely more surface area up front. They're more finicky. Like, if your form isn't exactly tight, they're not going to be as forgiving. So yeah, I mean, to me, I've kind of flipped the script.
Oh yeah. I'm all team mechanical. People are like, oh, it'll fail. I just don't think about it. It's not going to fail.
And I should. There's like a little bit of a caveat. I'm not like team mechanical across the board. There are definitely some mechanicals, you know, like the foldback design.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's ideal for everybody. Like, if you're not pushing a bunch of energy, if you're not shooting a pretty fast arrow that's like hard hitting to like adequately fold those blades back, I don't think that's the best choice. But for like the sever, which is like rear deploying, you know, it just slides into the ferrule and like opens up and it kind of pivots around any kind of bone. To me, I'm just like, this makes 100% sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like, people are always worried about penetration. Well, mm-hmm. if you want better penetration, shoot them in the lungs, shoot a smaller mechanical, like the sever 1.5. Like, that's what I use for elk. Sure. You know, yeah. It's a little bit smaller diameter. You're going to get better penetration instead of like a 2-inch, you know, mm-hmm. cutting diameter. But
yeah,
the severs, if anyone hasn't used them, I'd recommend. I've had a lot of good luck with the severs, and they came out. Those new ones look pretty sweet too. The hybrids.
Yeah. I want to try those. I'm interested in those. I mean, it's kind of a hybrid mix. You've got a 0.7, I think, bleeder blade that sits at the top end of it that's fixed, and then you've got the fold-out 1.5-inch mechanical mm-hmm. blades. I am interested to – I'm going to buy some and try them. I've had people – I bet I've had 30 DMs in the last week.
Asking about them?
Yeah, about that broadhead, and they're like, what do you think? And I'm like, well, I haven't shot it yet. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's interesting. I'm interested to see if they're as accurate. To me, in my mind, it doesn't make sense that they'd be quite as accurate because you have added more surface area and a fixed blade to the front end of that. So I would have to see like what the difference is and like what the trade-off is. If it's minimal or not at all, then great, I go for it. But kind of in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, the regular Sever 1.5s have been pretty damn good.
Yeah, I know.
Pretty tough to beat.
Yeah, they are. Plus, I got a bunch of them, so.
Sure.
Yeah. I got to go buy some new ones. Maybe we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. I mean, I think too. I mean, a lot of people are shooting single bevels at elk.
Sure.
I mean, a mechanical is not too far off from a single bevel. Besides, yeah. It opens up.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just interesting, and it's funny to me too that it's like I've heard a lot of people that are like, "Yeah, I'll shoot antelope, I'll shoot whitetail, I'll shoot mule deer with a mechanical." But when I go up to an elk, I have to shoot a fixed blade. You know, same thing as somebody was talking about. Oh, you know, moose or. To me, I'm just like I don't. It doesn't equate for me, you know.
Yeah.
Like. And I've told a bunch of people lately, they're like, well, I want to make sure I get a pass through. And I'm like, what good is a pass through if you don't have enough blood to follow?
Yeah.
Like, sure, two holes is better than one. They're going to bleed better. But I've had better blood trails from one hole from a mechanical than I have two holes from a fixed blade.
Yeah. I mean, more importantly than anything is hitting the spot you're aiming at. And I know with a mechanical, I'm going to have way better chance of hitting exactly where I'm aiming at, no matter what the distance is, than a fixed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. Have you listened to that podcast? It's the Finding Backcountry podcast where they had this guy, Jeremy Duggar, on.
Mm-mm.
So I mentioned it on our podcast, but go listen to it. It's the guy owns an archery shop, and he basically just like surveyed people as he set their bows up and bought equipment. He didn't steer them one way or the other. And then anytime that they would come back in and they had a hunt and whether they killed a bull or wounded a bull, he basically went back through and like collected data on what setup they used. It was really eye opening for me.
What was the data? What did it say?
Oh, mechanical's better. Yeah. More people found more elk with a mechanical. Also, it was interesting. He has like a pretty good correlation between the poundage that people are shooting and then finding a bull or wounding a bull. So like 80, 90 pounds, there was more people that higher poundage bows, people lost more elk.
Really?
Yeah. And it was basically kind of, in his opinion, tied to somebody's ability to hold it when you're nervous and execute a more accurate shot.
Who the hell is holding 90 pounds? Pulling
back. Which is great. I don't care. I don't fault anybody for it. I'm choose whatever you want. Like if you can pull 90 pounds and you can shoot it as accurate.
Sounds horrible.
It sounds horrible to me, but people do
it. I would hate to pull back 90 pounds every day. Yeah. Oh my God. My shoulder I'd have to have Tommy John's.
So here's interesting is like Lorenzo's shooting 80 pounds on a Matthews lift, right?
Uh-huh.
And he's got a couple twists in this cable. So I think we pulled it back one time on a scale and it's like 82 pounds. And I remember one day going down there and we were like kicking back and forth ideas of arrows and spines and whatnot. And he was like, yeah, shoot it through paper and see what you think. And I was like legit thinking like, I don't know that I can even draw and shoot 80 some pounds, right? Like, I don't know if I can. I was surprised how easily I could draw and shoot his bow. Mm-hmm. But in saying that, like if you go back to, I mean, there's a reason why people that shoot Vegas indoor shoots shoot 60 pounds or 55 pounds. It's because it's easier to pull back and aim and draw and execute a shot, right?
Right.
And I'm not advocating for people going to 60 pounds or 50 pounds to hunt per se, but you know, if you can draw 70 pounds and hold it, you could probably shoot it more accurately than you could 80 pounds.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I could think about that maybe I would like more poundage would be the added speed.
Sure.
So just have a little more forgiveness on those in-between yardages.
Yeah, but at what sacrifice?
Right.
If you're adding 10 pounds of, you know, you're adding more holding weight, in essence, are you going to be able to hold and shoot that bow as accurately? I don't know.
I just know my shoulder couldn't take that.
Yeah, me either.
Just over and over and over again. I think about all the time, like, lowering my poundage. I shoot 70. I'm like, damn, it'd be nice if this was about 60.
I've got some 65-pound mods, and they're pretty dope.
Yeah, I might be the opposite of the spectrum. I'm trying to go lower.
Mm-hmm. I've also had a bunch of people reaching out, and they're like, hey, I shoot 60 pounds. Would you still suggest a mechanical broadhead for me? And I go back to the first bull I ever killed. I shot with a Matthews Q2. Mm-hmm. And I shot that bow with a mechanical, a Grim Reaper, 3-blade, fold back, right? Broadhead. I shot him at 49 yards and clean through, total pass through. He didn't even know what hit him. He went over and, you know, died maybe 80 yards, tipped over dead. But I was telling this guy just the other day, they'd reached out. I'm like, if you were to compare energy, foot per second, with a Matthews Q2 from 2002 with your bow now at 60 pounds, I'll guarantee you're shooting better feet per second.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what most women, what are they shooting? Like 50 pounds?
Yeah. 50, 60.
60 pounds. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them are shooting. They'll shoot mechanicals.
Fast. Sure. Yeah, they're probably shooting as much kinetic energy as we would have been 20 years ago with the technology that was available in the bow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Team mechanical.
Good food for thought. Well, I've had you for an hour and 40 minutes. I better cut you loose. You said you have a haircut coming up, huh?
I got to go get my haircut.
You're getting all spruced up for the wedding.
Yep. I got my wedding. I got my friend's wedding coming up. I got a lot of weddings to go to.
You're in the thick of it.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, I'll cut you loose, man. I'll see you in a few weeks. We'll cruise out to Colorado and watch you get hitched.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Thanks for popping on with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet, man.
Okay, have a good one, bud.
Later.
Yep, bye.